I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Italian investigators say they've discovered Syrian ties to the alleged Iraqi-based terrorist group Ansar al-Islam. And Hezbollah, the militant terrorist group backed by Syria and Iran, has issued a new call to take up arms against Americans. Syria is already viewed by the U.S. as a state sponsor of terrorism, part of what one U.S. official recently called a junior axis of evil. But today's news comes as the Bush administration says Syria is also supporting Iraq. Joining us on the line from the Syrian capital of Damascus is Newsweek correspondent Christopher Dickey. Christopher, welcome.
My pleasure.
And we should say the U.S. has accused Syria, as you know, of supplying military equipment to Iraq, sheltering refugees of Saddam Hussein's regime, and developing chemical weapons. Syria has called these allegations baseless. From your vantage point, what do you think is going on here?
I think the Bush administration wants to take advantage of the enormous strength of its position right at this moment, actually to push Syria on other fronts that are not being explicitly addressed in these accusations, the main one being the peace process with Israel. I think that that's the reason that Colin Powell is talking about coming here. I don't think it's just to sort of reprimand them and wrap them on the knuckles and talk about a weapons program they've had for years or what are probably mostly non-existent refugees from the Ba'athi regime in Iraq. I think what he wants to do is say, look, get rid of the terrorist support for groups fighting Israel, and let's start talking and get down to the peace table, which is what would begin to salvage this whole operation.
Well, with that in mind, what would you make of what seemed to be renewed and louder calls from Hezbollah against the U.S.?
Hezbollah is not a client operation. It's partly supported by Iran, partly supported by Syria, but also has a lot of authority of its own. And it has kept a pretty low profile throughout this conflict. I think that that may just be rhetoric at the moment. I'm not sure that that's going to amount to anything.
You point out and remind us that Syria does have diplomatic relations with the U.S. despite being under some sanctions because of being accused of being a state supporter of terrorism. And Syria is thought to be a key ally in the campaign against al-Qaeda.
Exactly. That's why this supposed link to Ansar al-Islam is at best improbable. Now, conceivably, Syria managed to penetrate Ansar al-Islam and had some agents in there. I mean, I think that's a greater possibility than the idea that they were in collusion with or running Ansar al-Islam in some material way, because this regime has suffered mightily at the hands of fundamentalist Sunni terrorists over the years.
What's been the reaction to this increased war of words between the Assad regime and the Bush administration?
I think at first there was real fear that somehow the troops would just start moving from Iraq toward Syria. But now I think there's a realization that this is part of a diplomatic game and one that may actually be to the benefit of everybody.
And Bashar Assad, quickly, he succeeded his father as Syrian president. He's young, 37 years old. How is he seen in the region, and what's your thoughts of how he's playing out this crisis?
He's seen as somebody who wants to be more progressive than he has been able to be, because the regime is still dominated by the dinosaurs who surrounded his father. Now there is a change in the objective reality of the Middle East. If he wants to take advantage of that, I think that the United States is saying quietly behind the scenes, good, take advantage of it, and everybody will be happier.
But he certainly has increased in popularity.
Because he looks like he's standing up for the Arab cause at a time when Saddam Hussein collapsed. Nobody can believe that Baghdad fell in a day. What people say here is Jenin, a town in the Palestinian territories, held out for 13 days against the Israeli army, and Baghdad didn't hold out for one day against the United States. So Syria looks good if it holds a firm diplomatic position, but it doesn't look good if it has to face the might of the American army, and it certainly is going to try and avoid that.
Christopher Dickey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Dickey, Newsweek correspondent, speaking to us from Damascus in Syria. Baghdad is still a city with a huge leadership vacuum. Some policemen have returned to their posts, but there are no government agencies and few services at all. So who are people turning to for help? In many cases, the local imam and the Muslim mosque. Dick Gordon, host of NPR's The Connection, is in Baghdad. Welcome, Dick.
Hi, Robin.
Well, we hear you're hearing about the religious community's leadership everywhere you go, including at the hospitals.
You can't avoid it. In fact, every time people are talking about what they don't get from
a government that doesn't exist or the Americans who they wish would provide something. They say that they are turning to the mosque. If you go to Saddam Children's Hospital in Baghdad, the first person that you come upon is a man wearing a blue smock carrying a Kalashnikov rifle, making sure that unsavory elements don't come into the hospital. He is a volunteer from the mosque. In fact, when I was there, there were a number of Shiite clerics meeting with hospital director Dr. Hasim Rahim Issa to hear him describe the situation. They simply couldn't get by without the assistance they're getting from the local mosques now.
As you know, we have no government, no police, no policeman. There's some criminal people outside. So we must depend on trust people. And the mosque, they are trust people.
You would be in real trouble without the help of the mosque
yes,
now.
Yes. We are alone. So if we don't help them, we'll lost our hospital.
But Dick Gornin, what about the tension we're hearing about between the mosques and the religious faiths, you know, the Hussein-backed Sunni and the previously repressed Shiites, for example?
I don't think Baghdad's a particularly good place to put your finger on that, except for the fact that it's the capital city, and when the end game happens, it's going to take place here. But there's certainly a number of Shiite here. They've, in fact, renamed their part of the city. Used to be called Saddam City. They're now calling it Al-Sidr City, which is named after an Ayatollah, an Iraqi Ayatollah, who was murdered. And it's a way of stating that reestablishment of political control. The sheikhs see this wonderful opportunity now to serve the people, to provide the water, to give them food if necessary. That's what mosques have always done. But it also gives them an opportunity to establish a political power base, which could be crucial in the future. On the other hand, the Sunni imams who were with the ruling Ba'ath party are very nervous about how this shift will affect them because, as you point out, they're in the minority.
Mm. Well, and let's talk a little bit about that future because there are many people worried about Shia infighting. The murder of the Shia cleric last week was by a mob led by a younger Shia cleric. And so some worry this could signal a rise of a younger, more radical faction of Shia clerics, and they immediately start thinking of Iran. So what are you seeing there about the future, Baghdad and elsewhere, of Iraq perhaps going the way of Iran?
Well, you're right to point to the East here, because certainly the Shia strength that exists in this part of the world is focused in Iran, and there are people in Iran who have come to Iraq, and we will see them in the months ahead. Well, we won't see them, but we'll hear about them trying to create discord between various factions of the Shia who are more interested in being part of a sort of diverse federal Iraq will... there'll be targets on them. There may be some attacks on Sunnis. It's going to take a great deal of backbone for Iraq to resist the sort of elements that will want to create divisions. And the real problem with that right now, Robin, of course, is that there's no backbone. There's not even a body. There is no government. There is no leader. And so, the gates to the playground are wide open. Mm-hmm. And until something happens, there's going to be all kinds of potential for fundamentalism and for religious unrest.
Dick, very briefly before we have to let you go, what about the tiny Christian minority? Are they feeling threatened?
The numbers are really just too small, Robin, for them to feel like they're going to be a part of some kind of Muslim infighting or war that would take place. The fact is that the Christians have lived here for hundreds of years under the radar. They aspire to no political power. They simply want to be left alone. And largely that's what has happened. And they're hoping and expecting that that's what will happen in the future.
Dick, thank you so much.
Robin, you're welcome.
Dick Gornin, host of NPR's The Connection, speaking to us from Baghdad. For more on his reporting, go to our website, here-now.org.
Well, Good Friday is tomorrow, a sacred, solemn day for Christians. And at the Pentagon, Christians will take part in a prayer service. The homily to be delivered by Reverend Franklin Graham, son of America's most famous televangelist, Billy Graham. Franklin Graham was requested by Pentagon employees. His planned appearance, though, has shocked and infuriated many American Muslims because of what Graham said in the past about Islam. One example, he's called the faith of Muhammad a very evil and wicked religion. To explore now more who Franklin Graham is and for a look at his charitable organization, Samaritan's Purse, which at the moment is planning to go into Iraq, we're joined by Professor Lamin Saneh, who's professor of history at Yale Divinity School. Welcome, Professor.
Yes. Hello.
Professor, should Reverend Graham be giving a homily at the Pentagon at this point in time?
Well, I think many people are dismayed by the news. And I should say it's not only Muslims, but there are many on the Christian side who are equally dismayed.
Hasn't he done a lot of good and charitable work from Central America to Africa and now possibly Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. But I would have thought that that does not immunize him against criticism. I mean, it'd be an awful thing if Christian charity entitles us to offending other people.
The Pentagon employees invited Franklin Graham, and yet the U.S. government itself has been critical of Franklin Graham, directing his missionaries in Samaritan's Purse to more clearly delineate prayer services from aid work when they were working in El Salvador. In the first Gulf War, Reverend Graham locked horns with General Schwarzkopf because Graham gave troops Bibles in Arabic, which he then encouraged the troops to hand out to Arabs, yes?
Yes.
Now, how concerned would you be about Samaritan's Purse, Franklin Graham's group, going into Iraq at this point, given their history of, although they say they will not do this, their history of proselytizing?
Well, I'm very concerned. I think it's ill-timed and ill-advised. And I would have thought this is the time to lie low, to let the Iraqis themselves sort out their own issues and their own problems. And if they want help, they can ask for it.
But doesn't doing good efficiently trump the question of some proselytizing along the way? Shouldn't they be given some leeway to perhaps prevent their point of view spiritually?
Yeah, but the basis of Christian good is the teaching of Christianity that human beings are made in the image of God. And it seems to me that you cannot attack people's dignity, their human dignity, and do them good at the same time. That seems to me a contradiction in terms. So doing good should not mean that you ignore, overlook, or trample on the dignity of human beings you're trying to help.
Professor, how concerned are you, if at all, about a kind of Christianization of the U.S. government right now, a very, very devout, even evangelically based faith for President Bush and many around him? Mr. Franklin Graham is quite close to President Bush, is he not?
I gather he is, yes.
Is our government becoming too close to one religion?
Well, yes, I've thought about that. Actually, I think it's the other way around, that Christianity has become a commodity in America. And what I'm afraid of is not the Christianization of America, but the Americanization of Christianity, so that Christianity becomes a department of American patriotism. And I think that's far more worrying, because America is very, very complex as a society. And the form of Christianity that is in bed with the political leadership is a form that is very congenial to the American spirit, but cannot really be exported to other parts of the world in a successful way.
Professor Laman Saneh is professor of history at the Yale Divinity School. Samaritan's Purse declined to speak with us.
Just ahead, no shaking hands in church in Toronto, a whole apartment building sick in China, the progress and the problems in the fight against SARS.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There are now more than 3,000 suspected cases of SARS around the world, almost 200 of them in this country. We're asking, are you worried about severe acute respiratory syndrome?
Not personally, no.
Well, I am because we deal with international students who come to the United States to study. I'm worried more about it for them not being allowed to get into the country.
I'm concerned about it, but I'm not sure where it comes from. So I don't know how to protect myself.
A little bit, actually. My girlfriend's roommate is about to move to Hong Kong for a job, actually. So it's definitely on my mind. She just came back from Hong Kong to visit.
I'm watching it, but not at this point. Although I was in Newark Airport a week ago, and I did notice that a lot of people did have the face masks on.
Thoughts on SARS from some of the people we spoke with today.
Well, Robin, while public health officials around the world fight the SARS virus, the government of China stands accused now of covering up the severity of the epidemic in Beijing. Nearly half the world's reported SARS patients are in China, with more than 1,400 suspected cases on the mainland and more than 1,200 in Hong Kong. And yesterday, World Health Organization researchers said they believe there may be 200 cases of the new lung infection in China's capital city. Now, that's more than five times the official government estimate. Some have expressed serious concern about the ability of the Chinese public health system to cope with the emerging disease. John Pomfret of The Washington Post joins us now from Beijing. Hello, John.
How are you?
Thanks for joining us. John, you're in a city, Beijing, of 13 million. Even if the WHO estimates of 200 SARS cases are true, that's still a very small percentage. Is there any evidence of concern about SARS on the streets of Beijing?
The sense of concern, even in some quarters, panic, is definitely evident. Last week, you couldn't barely see a face mask in town. Now the face masks are all over the place. The government has teams scrubbing down schools, buses, office buildings with disinfectant. Some schools have been let out because of rumors or cases among the relatives of school children. Several departments in Beijing University aren't teaching because SARS has infected people in those schools. So SARS is definitely in Beijing now, and Beijing city government has woken up to the threat of this disease.
Remarkably blunt language from the WHO, the World Health Organization, essentially accusing the Chinese government of a cover-up. How is that going down in Beijing?
Well, this whole epidemic has been a very bad public relations disaster for the government in terms of its relations with the average Chinese. Generally, you would want to rely on your government for prompt and accurate information about an epidemic that is moving in your society. The problem is that people have been forced to rely on text messaging, internet emails, rumors to get information about SARS because the government for such a long period of time basically didn't tell them anything. And when it told them, always turned out to be inaccurate.
What is your sense? Cover up or just a degree of incompetency in a massive public health system?
I think it's a combination of both. I think the cover up angle is very strong for two reasons. One, because I think some officials and perhaps even some senior officials did not want to get China slapped with any type of a travel ban, even though they got it anyway. They're very worried about how this disease could affect foreign investment, foreign travel, which are all huge sources of hard currency for the Chinese government and for their economy. So there's that motivation. The second thing also, there is an incompetence angle. I mean, this country has an enormous bureaucracy. It's about 1.3, 1.5 billion people. Running something of that size is a Herculean task. And there's a lot of things that slip through the cracks.
Is there a travel ban recommended now to China? To Hong Kong,
the
yes.
The WHO,
but
for the first time in 55 years, about 10 days ago, recommended that unnecessary travel be put off for Hong Kong and southern China, Guangdong province, which is the source of this disease. They have not recommended that unnecessary travel be put off for Beijing.
Can the public health system in China cope with this emerging threat?
That's a really good question, because we all know about China's old medical system under the socialist days of barefoot doctors and free medical care for the masses. But in the last 10 years, that whole system has collapsed, and China's medical system has actually become one of the most elitist in the world, where everyone has to pay, and of course, the people who can pay the most get the best care. That is not the type of system that's going to be able to deal with SARS. And there's a lot of concern that once it moves out into the poorer provinces, this thing could spread very rapidly and could not be stopped.
John Pomfret, thanks so much for joining us from Beijing.
Welcome.
Washington Post correspondent John Pomfret spoke to us from Beijing, China.
And now this roundup of other SARS news, beginning with the announcement by World Health Organization scientists yesterday that severe acute respiratory system has now officially been linked to a previously unknown virus, a type of coronavirus related to the germ that causes the common cold.
Meanwhile, the number of SARS cases around the world continues to increase. There are now 199 suspected cases in the United States. Officials with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta say spread of the disease in this country has so far been limited to family members and close contacts of infected patients.
SARS has also arrived in India and Africa. Doctors in India say their single patient has recovered and is no longer contagious. A CDC scientist says it's not possible to predict how the SARS virus will affect the millions of Africans whose immune systems are already weakened by HIV.
The spread of the SARS virus to 324 people in a Hong Kong apartment building has been traced to leaky sewage pipes and a single patient with diarrhea. Doctors say there has also been person-to-person transmission, but no sign of airborne spread in that building.
And in the Canadian province of Ontario, where 10,000 people have been quarantined because of SARS, health officials have asked anyone who feels sick to avoid religious and family gatherings over the Easter weekend and to bow rather than shake hands at the traditional handshake of peace in church.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a conversation about Native American patriotism with the president of the Navajo Nation.
And we review the new Nick Nolte film, The Good Thief. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, nobody knows when the oil will start flowing again from Iraq's vast reserves, but many analysts say when it does, the operation should be under local management.
We would be making a very, very serious error politically and tactically if we attempted to bring people from the outside to run the Iraqi oil industry, because we will run into some very serious resistance from these people who know their industry very well.
And in a time of war, a former U.S. ambassador's cantata for peace.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. U.S. troops in Iraq have captured another half-brother of Saddam Hussein. Barzan Hassan reportedly ran Hussein's intelligence operations in Europe while he was Iraq's ambassador to U.N. agencies in Geneva. General Vincent Brooks says Hassan is a vital suspect.
We saw the role of Barzan Ibrahim Hassan al-Tikriti as an advisor to former President Saddam Hussein. We believe that he is an insider. And in terms of priorities, about 38 on our list of 55 top individuals that we believe have key information about the regime.
Hassan is one of three half-brothers of Saddam and the second to be captured. Tensions are playing out in the streets of Baghdad. U.S. commanders are trying to ease the anti-American anger after 2 days of confrontations involving Marines in the city of Mosul. Associated Press correspondent Lourdes Navarro reports.
The shootings in Mosul and the tensions in the north can only fuel what is becoming a lot of anti-American sentiment that is even being felt here in Baghdad in front of the Palestine Hotel. Today, again, there were continuing demonstrations by people wanting the Americans to put in an Iraqi government and calling the war effort here an invasion and not a liberation.
United Nations officials are saying that looters who pillaged and stole Iraqi antiquities had keys to museum vaults. Cultural experts gathered at the UN today to discuss the looting of Iraqi museums and libraries that took place in the aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion. The experts believe that some of the looting was deliberate and planned, where thieves knew what they were looking for and where to find it. European leaders are continuing to call for a central role for the United Nations in post-war Iraq. At a European Union summit today, Britain and Spain joined with France and Germany in drafting a statement to bring swift humanitarian and political assistance to the Iraqi people. The main event of the summit was the signing of a treaty formalizing the entry of 10 nations, including Cyprus, Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, and Slovenia, into the EU by May of 2004. Unemployment is at its highest levels this year, according to the latest statistics from the Labor Department. New applications for jobless benefits rose by 400,000 applications for the work week ending April 12th, indicating a stagnant job market. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 23 points at 82.81. The Nasdaq is up 19 points at 14.14. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Baghdad, hospitals, museums, and banks have been ransacked. But one key building remains untouched by the looters, guarded by U.S. tanks at the gates and sharpshooters on the rooftops. It's the Iraqi Ministry of Oil. Critics say this shows that the war really was all about oil. The U.S. government denies that, saying the oil ministry is the fount of the country's wealth. It needs to be protected to generate the billions of dollars needed to buy Iraq's future. So, when will that happen? Joining us from Nicosia, Cyprus, is Waleed Kaddouri, editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey. Hello, Waleed.
Hi.
And also Yusuf Ibrahim. He's a former New York Times Middle East correspondent and author of the upcoming book, War and Oil. Yusuf, welcome again.
Hi.
Yusuf joins us from Dubai. And Yusuf, to you first. Just clarify for us, is there no oil flowing in Iraq or from Iraq?
As far as I know, at this point, there is no oil flowing from Iraq, or if there is, it's insignificant in terms of numbers. They still have to sort out the legal situation first. But the Marines did make an announcement, I believe, and Waleed would be able to confirm that they were planning to pump some 220,000 barrels a day from the south.
But Waleed?
They were,
yeah. Well, Waleed, I think that the first thing to do now is really to produce oil to
supply the power stations and the refineries in Iraq to have electricity and gasoline.
Well, let's talk about the bigger picture. What's the situation at the oil ministry? Waleed, we'll stay with you. Are people showing up for work, and who are these people?
Yeah, well, Iraqi oil professionals have been running the industry for some four decades now. And as far as I know, and reports from Baghdad, that they've already, in the oil ministry in Baghdad, they have started working, and they are trying to put things together. But in the south and the north and the fields, there's the security problem and remobilizing people. That could be a hindrance. But they think they will be back to work in about 2 weeks.
Youssef, this is a government that's been described as one dominated by Ba'ath Party thugs. Where does the oil ministry fall in that?
I mean, it's totally different. I believe the total number of the Iraqi technocrats is about 60,000. They are thorough professionals. In fact, it's miraculous the way they have kept oil flowing in the past 12 years with the sanctions. And I think we would be making a very, very serious error politically and tactically if we attempted to bring people from the outside to run the Iraqi oil industry, because we will run into some very serious resistance from these people who know their industry very well. You got to remember, Robin, these were the same people who refused actually to carry out any orders to sabotage the oil fields. So essentially, these are professionals and they are Iraqi patriots.
They're being described as a world-class group of people. So, Waleed, it seems as if the people are there, the infrastructure is still pretty much there. What's the problem?
The problem is legal, in the sense that Iraqi oil is still under Security Council resolutions under sanctions. And for the U.S. to start exporting oil needs a new Security Council resolution, and that means compromises with France and Russia and other permanent members in the Security Council. So there has to be some political process, some time of negotiations to come up with a new resolution, expected sometime in early June.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the current U.N. Oil for Food program does end June 3rd. President Bush has now called for a lifting of the U.N. sanctions that created the need for the program. And Youssef, some say Bush's call is a move to get the U.N. out of the business of sanctions and Iraqi oil.
I think there are some question marks over this. Why now are we in a hurry to lift the sanctions, when for 12 years we absolutely, definitely didn't want them lifted? Of course, you can say it's because Saddam Hussein is gone, but also you could also say it's because the United States wants to put a puppet government in Baghdad and basically proceed to give all these contracts to American oil companies.
Well, Waleed, this is part of what's being called the big debate, the talks between the U.S. and U.N. as to who will actually run the oil business in Iraq in the future. But isn't it true that right now, legally, the only one who can run it is SOMO, Iraq's state oil marketing organization?
The only one who can export oil. So they have to sign the contracts for export to give orders for lifting, and there is no SOMO now.
Why can't SOMO just run it?
Well, basically, there is still no administration in Iraq. There is no government, there's no authority, there's no oil minister. So there has to be some kind of authority in Baghdad to give orders to SOMO or for SOMO to function properly with a proper head. There's a big vacuum in Baghdad, administration and government-wise. Either American or Iraqi, for that matter.
Yeah. In fact, Youssef, we read that Iraqi officials actually would welcome American business to come in and help them run the industry.
I think that is probably true, but the language I would use is different. They would, a sovereign Iraqi government will welcome and choose those companies that will come to help them, and it will do so on a competitive basis. Yes, I'm sure an independent Iraqi government would indeed welcome American oil companies because they are very good companies, but it will not be only American oil companies.
Waleed, we're talking about the big debate between the U.S. and the U.N. and how they might cooperate in the future with Iraq's oil. Some would say that U.N. members, including France, which had contracts with Iraq prior to the war, would be just as eager to step in and take advantage of that. What about those existing contracts?
Well, you know, there are no contracts. I mean, I don't know where that came from. France does not have any what they call production sharing contract in Iraq. They negotiated one, but they never concluded it. They didn't sign it. because of the UN sanctions.
But don't they have a memorandum of understanding?
That's not where the ink on the paper. It doesn't mean anything, no. Memorandum of understanding in oil. There is no contract. France has no legitimate title. The Russians have one, and the Chinese have one, and that's all.
Yeah. What?
But oil contracts worldwide are done through bidding, open bidding, and that's how it should be done in Iraq. It should not be restricted to one country or to one company. And in any case, I don't think any one company would like to dominate in Iraq because of the political risk.
Yeah. Walid, do you think that will happen, and when do you think that might happen?
Well, as far as the development of Iraqi oil, that I don't think can happen before 2 or 3 years when there is a freely elected government, because either a military administration or a transit government cannot really sign investment agreements for 25 years. They are not allowed to do that. So until we have a constitution and a parliament and an elected government, there is no way that anyone can sign 20-25-year investment agreements for each one of them, about $3 to $5 billion.
But you mentioned the oil for food program is up in June. When might oil start flowing?
Probably around then.
Yeah.
Probably around then, in a significant basis, not before. I doubt if there would be any oil before then.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Speaking to us from Nicosia, Cyprus, Walid Kaddouri, editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey. And from Dubai, we were joined by Youssef Ibrahim, a former New York Times reporter and author of the upcoming book, War and Oil.
Still to come, interweaving Christ's final words and writings of suffering, hope, and the Holocaust. A talk with the composer of The Witness Cantata.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our editorial roundtable about media censorship and war provoked this email from Robin Carpenter of Hanover, New Hampshire, who writes, "One of your panelists complains of being labeled anti-American. Well, I suspect he is, based on his tone of weary irony, despairing of all things American. How else to explain his surprise that the middle of a war is not the time to be publishing every fact or rumor that floats by? He seems to think we put on the war for the sole purpose of validating journalistic careers."
But Scott Weir of Durham, North Carolina, had a different take. Scott writes, "There is a small but extremely noisy faction in this country which has branded every person who dares question their point of view as anti-American or unpatriotic. The only antidote is for those of us who know the truth to shout it from the rooftops."
After hearing our interview with Robert Fuller, author of Somebodies and Nobodies, Overcoming the Abuse of Rank, listener Teresa Rauart writes, "I see rankism happening all of the time in the workplace. Most workers believe they have to put up with it. I've been fired from jobs in the past because I refuse to be treated with such disrespect."
Our coverage of the war is still generating a lot of mail. Claire Cabral of Merrimack, New Hampshire writes, "One of the reasons given for war was security. As far as that goes, I believe Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak when he says 100 new bin Ladens have been created because of the war. And one more thing, how much is it going to cost taxpayers? Ouch."
Janet Linder of Auburndale, Massachusetts, was upset about our use of the phrase pockets of resistance when talking about the dangers facing U.S. soldiers still based in Afghanistan. She left this voicemail.
"To say there are, quote, pockets of resistance is just using a cliche that is meaningless, misleading. I'm not impressed. There are way more than pockets of resistance in Afghanistan. The country is a mess. Many areas are controlled by warlords. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are still operating. We have not installed democracy there, and we are not anywhere close to that."
Bob Pientadosi heard our conversation with former weapons inspector David Kay and writes, "Even if weapons of mass destruction are found in Iraq, some will say the evidence was planted. So now that most of the military threat is over, why not allow the UN inspections team to go along with our own people, if for no other reason than to add a further layer of legitimacy to the findings?"
After our talk with actor Robert Duvall, we got this email from Steve Follinsby. "Listen to the show on the way to Fenway Park. Making fun of Robert Duvall's bow legs. Mean, mean, mean. Well, Steve, you can bet your Red Sox I would not make fun of bow legs unless someone else did first. And Robert Duvall cast his own legs in a scene-stealing role in his new movie, Assassination Tango.
And finally, Wes Gallome wrote to say he enjoyed Scott Alaric's historical review of folk protest songs and adds, I cut my teeth on the music you were playing yesterday, but I never associated Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream with Joan Baez. I first heard it on an early Simon and Garfunkel album. In the last few years, I've been singing it to my 5-year-old daughter. Being an atheist, I changed the words from grateful prayers were prayed to grateful dead was played. Recently, I lapsed to the original words, and my daughter stopped me and said, Dad, you're singing the wrong words.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
And when the papers all were signed,
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Sunday is Easter, when Christians celebrate what they believe followed Jesus' death on the cross, resurrection, rebirth, a theme composer Swanee Hunt explores in her choral work, The Witness Cantata, a work especially resonant this year after so many weeks of war in Iraq and now the first fragile steps toward peace. Hunt wrote the cantata 15 years ago. She's not a full-time composer. The work was written, in fact, a few years before she became Bill Clinton's ambassador to Austria. It's a piece that's structured around Jesus' last 7 words on the cross, words then interwoven with writings by people like Elie Wiesel and the poet Anna Akhmatova, who also endured suffering and overcame suffering. Recently, I visited Swanee Hunt as she and members of the Boston Landmark Orchestra were rehearsing for the Boston premiere of The Witness Cantata.
I was interested in taking the enormously important symbol of the God who is hanging on the gallows and all of the disturbing mystery that that evokes. And the reason I took contemporary writings to interpret the sayings of Jesus on the cross was because I think that they are applicable to today. The writings of Elie Wiesel about what he saw when he was in Auschwitz, the writings of Anna Akhmatova, whose only son was imprisoned for 18 years to keep her from writing her poetry because she was such a powerful, popular force, a voice of the people
in
the Soviet Union when Stalin came into power. And her husband was killed, her lover was killed, her son was imprisoned, and she would write out of that despair.
Thank you.
ends with an Anna Akhmatova poem.
Yes, with just enough hope to get you through to Easter morning. Because the peace takes you into, you know, deeper and deeper darkness. And then Akhmatova's words at the end bring you out. And she says, everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wing scrapes the air. Misery gnaws to the bone. Why then do we not despair? By day from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. And the miraculous comes so close to our ruined, dirty houses. Something not known to anyone before, but wild in our breasts for centuries.
How important is the Christian setting, the Christian context that this work is in?
Well, it could just as well have been in a context of another faith. This is simply the one I was raised in. I love several pieces of the Christian tradition. And Easter, you know, Easter, interestingly enough, has never been as important to me as, except maybe as the statement that ultimately there is this larger context for good. And it's not that all our problems are going to work out. And I don't believe that everything happens for a purpose. I'm not one of those. It makes me crazy when friends of mine say, well, so-and-so's child has just been diagnosed with leukemia, but we know that everything happens for a purpose. I don't think so. And no God that I would want to worship would be planning children's painful death. It's not where I am, and that's not where this cantata is either.
Dark and deep songs by baritones and the soprano, the piece ends with sort of the innocence of these boy sopranos.
The boy soprano is very important to this piece because it's both the innocence that Elie Wiesel watched hanging on the gallows at Auschwitz. He was watching the actual hanging of a 14-year-old boy, and he was 14 himself. And you have this innocence there on the gallows. And then a voice of a man behind Elie Wiesel said, where is God now? And kept saying, where is God? Where is God? And Wiesel says, and I heard a voice within me answer him, here he is hanging there on the gallows.
You're a believer with questions.
Oh, I find the anchor of my faith isn't in the logic I can put together. If I think about prevailing forces in the world, I am overcome with the evil that I see. And yet I'm also at other times overcome with a sense of good. And I don't mean to be dualistic here as I describe this, but I have to believe that there is some kind of prevailing force for good.
What then do we take away from the Witness Cantata? It's a dark work. There's a lot of dark music in it. There's a lot of dark poetry. Can you put it in words, or is it...
I can try to step back and look at the cantata as a whole, as a statement, as a metaphor. And it is that the experience of the suffering is both highly individual, but it's also collective. And no matter what I experience in my own life that can lead me into tremendous sense of sadness, it probably will never match what Anna Akhmatova experienced with her only child imprisoned for 18 years, or what Elie Wiesel experienced in his years at Auschwitz. And yet these people wrote about it. They had that strength, that internal strength to say, I'm going to take this experience and it's not going to defeat me. I prevail beyond this. I am something bigger than this. My life and all of life is bigger than this suffering. God is bigger than this suffering. That's the great hope for us all.
In Theodore Retke's poem, The Dying Man, which is in some ways a centerpiece in a way of the cantata, he ends with the dying man full of song, singing.
I am that final thing, a man learning to sing.
I heard a dying man say to his gathered kin.
Composer Swanee Hunt currently teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. For more information on The Witness Cantata, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest developments.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. MathWorks.com.